Well, the scriptures say that we should dwell upon all things that are lovely and good and of good report. So we're going to try and do that in light of the kind of grim, somewhat sobering statement on what's going on in our nation. So what's good and lovely? Well, we're going to talk about marriage. Now, I'm going to just, I have a number of caveats and things like that built into the sermon because it's a difficult subject because as you start talking about marriage, there's lots of times where, you know, I can read stuff and say, oh man, I don't know if I'm the best example of that. Do I do that? And there are places where I think, man, if I say that a certain way, well, so-and-so might interpret my comments as meaning this about their life and this about their life. So I've got a few in there. This is like my overarching umbrella caveat. If you find something in there that bothers you, come and talk to me about it. I'm trying to be sensitive to people's situations, but stick to the truth and stick to the church's teaching on marriage as much as possible. I mean, I have my own way of saying things, but I believe I'm in complete agreement with the church's teaching on the matter. So the statement that we read from the Council of Elders included kind of drew our attention to the biblical teaching that human marriage reflects the spiritual relationship between Christ and the church. So that's the thing, you know, I'm saying whatever is good and lovely and of good report and worth dwelling upon. And even though we live out our marriages in the flesh, marriage is a spiritual relationship as much as it is a physical relationship. It's both. It's like two mints in one. It's spiritual and physical. And it's a relationship that is desirable and purposeful. I think that's one of the reasons why the barbarians are banging down the gate trying to get in. It's something that's desirable. It's a good thing. It can go off the tracks and it can be difficult and there can be problems. Forgot to set my stopwatch there. I'll just go with the clock. I must have hit the button while I was singing. I have a question. It's a rhetorical question. You can answer if you want, but you don't have to. There's a fellow in Greensboro who answers all my questions. He always answers, blah, blah. And sometimes I have to say, not exactly. But we have fun with it. Most of the times we're on the same page. Has God given us instructions to follow for marriage? Or are we left on our own to figure it all out? You know, figure out the whens and whys and wherefores and who fors, you know, who could get married? What can you marry? You know, can you marry another man? Can you marry a cow? Can you have, you know, can two men marry one woman? Can five women marry one man? Can you throw a cow in for good measure and call it a marriage? No, you can't. You cannot do that. Are we left wondering what God really intended for marriage? Well, the answer is, and I know you knew this already, so it was a safe rhetorical question. God, our Creator, has indeed given us sound instructions regarding marriage. So the title for the sermon, if you will, I think, it's my working title, is The First Marriage. The First Marriage. The importance of marriage in the Bible is, I think, perhaps best seen in its placement in the book. If anyone of you have ever taken a course in journalism, you'll know one of the first rules of journalism is you put the important stuff at the beginning, assuming that as people read through the article, they're going to drop off. Well, hopefully that's not the case with the Bible, but it does share that way of working with information. It's very important, and it's placed at the very beginning. After creation, the Bible begins with what? A married couple. A man and a woman joined together. Think about it. It's right there at the very beginning of the Bible. It's almost like saying, okay, before we get started on any of this other stuff, let's just get this straight. Like you might do when you're talking to someone, just, you know, having a conversation. In the beginning, God made two models in his own likeness, after his own kind. One was male, and the other was female. Now, I know you know this verse, and we turn there an awful lot. I was thinking about it as I was writing this. I thought, boy, we spend an awful lot of time in the first three chapters of the Bible. Because we just seem to have to go back and reestablish fundamental things. And the fundamental things start at the very beginning. So in chapter 1 and verse 27, we read that, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Now, note, the fact that they were different sexually, but still both in God's image, tells us that sexuality, or gender, is not a factor in being made in God's image. All right? Just wanted to establish some basic things. So men and women are both created in the image of God for a tremendous purpose. God the Creator gave the man and the woman, among other things, the ability to reproduce through sex. He said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Often cited as the easiest and most popular commandment, but that is something that God instructed us to do, men and women. Be fruitful and increase in number. A man who marries a cow is not going to be able to increase in number. You have to marry a woman to do that. Women, you have to marry a man to do that. So the first man and the first woman had body parts that fit together in an obvious manner that made reproduction and increase possible, that made it happen. Now, this is a truth from biology and creation that should be self-evident, as we read a little bit or alluded to in Romans 1. Some things you should just be able to figure out by looking at creation. That's what God tells us in Romans 1. And I think that's one of them. It's self-evident. I'm not saying that people don't have problems with hormonal imbalance and things like that. However, some things are self-evident. I think this is one of them. And doesn't it just kind of amaze you sometimes that we actually have to talk about stuff like this and reaffirm things like that, that are just like, what? Seriously? We have to go over that? Well, apparently we do. What did God say about what I'm calling this self-evident reality? Well, he looked at everything that he had made, and, you know, man and woman and sex and reproduction and all that stuff, and he said in verse 31, if you're there, just drop down, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. It was good, and it's for a good purpose, as we'll see. Sexuality is more than just having the right parts, though. It's the centerpiece of a relationship that takes place on a very high level. I'm going to call it a God-plane relationship. Kind of going back into the archives, pulling out some golden nuggets. It's a God-plane relationship. It's on a high level. And the church holds marriage in the highest esteem. Because the Bible does. And the Bible tells us to do that. Marriage between a man and a woman. High level. God-plane relationship. It doesn't mean that people don't take it in terrible directions. The model that we have is a high-plane, God-level relationship. And it teaches us about the relationship of Christ and the church, which is important for all of us here because we are the church. So there's a lot that we can learn by looking at it. Genesis 2, verse 18. Staying at the beginning. Genesis 2, verse 18. The Lord God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. So this, the way it's played out here is Adam is created first, and then God says, it's not good for him to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him, all right? Or a suitable companion, or a companion comparable to him. So man was not designed to be alone. A man is designed to be with a woman. Another self-evident truth, I think. Likewise, the woman was explicitly and specifically made to be a companion on his own level. Now, I did a little word study. I know you guys know that I do this. I look up the words. I looked up the word helper. And I have this program that'll look it up and it'll show me all the places in the Bible where it's used. And this is a Hebrew word, of course. And it's a translation of the Hebrew word azer or aizer. I don't know how to pronounce Hebrew. A-Y-Z-E-R is the like English phonetic alphabet version of it. It's used 21 times in the Old Testament. Most of those occurrences of the word helper are used to describe God in action, which I thought was fascinating. I'll give you an example from Psalm 33, verse 20. We wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. So most of the times that you see the word helper used in Hebrew, it's talking about God helping you. So it's not necessarily conveying a sense of subordination that is common when we use the word helper in the English language. Like when you use the word helper, I don't know about you, but I think like the maid or the cook or the hired hand or something like that. Now, I say this because I thought it was interesting, but also I say this to emphasize the high level of the relationship. Because the woman is not created inferior to the man. She has a different status from the man. But she is a helper suitable for the man. It's a God-plane level relationship. This marriage relationship we're talking about, between two beings, each made in the image of God. Now, don't fret. I will cover the respective roles of male and female in marriage, but I'm going to do that later on in the sermon. My point is to draw out and emphasize the high level of the relationship. Who are we dealing with here? Now, my first caveat. This is not intended to be a slam or a put down or putting aside anyone who's single or not married. And some people remain single their whole lives. Some people are, you know, young and they're in a state where they're not yet married. Other people are divorced, I know that. It's not intended to be a slam against someone who is in a single state. A single person can be whole and complete. Jesus himself was single, was he not? Paul drew out the spiritual significance of singleness in his epistles. But right now, we're talking about marriage. So this is my first caveat. Because there's just so many ways I can offend people. I just want to cover some of them up front and let you know, I'm purposely leaving that whole part of the argument out. Because we're talking about marriage here. So where do we find the most important biblical teaching on marriage? We've talked about scriptures that there's a man and a woman and they're two and all that. But where do we start getting into, the nitty and the gritty of how it's done? Well, it's right there at the beginning as well. Just drop down to verse 24 in chapter 2. I'm going to read a very important two verses regarding marriage. Verse 24 of chapter 2 says, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. All right? Yes, I used the word naked, boys. No giggling required. So once again, we see right here at the very beginning of the book, a very important instruction about marriage. And from this very short verse, we're going to draw out four fundamental concepts regarding marriage: leaving, joining, oneness, goodness, kind of my flip version of, you know, not ashamed, goodness. And then I'm going to tag on another one, which is authority, which was not in that verse, but we're going to add that. So we've got five things we're going to talk about. One, leaving your father and mother to establish a new family unit. And people throughout history have had different ways that they handle the whole issue, whether the newly married couple lives with the mother's family or the father's family, or they make a new room for them, or whether they go off and have their own abode, their own home. And that's all neither here nor there, because the concept is that you leave your father and mother to establish a new family unit. Honoring your parents, closeness to your parents, seeking out their wisdom and advice is a good thing, and it's highly advised, highly advised. However, you two are a new family unit. A new family unit. The family that you grew up in as a child had its way of doing things. You know, well, we always have dinner at 6. That's the right and true way. You have your way of doing things. Little habits, some things are important, some things are trivial. But that does not mean that your spouse will want to do things the same way. And all of you who are married, you know, hopefully you're thinking, yeah, that's definitely the way it works. For those of you who are not married but hope to be, let me tell you in advance, that's the way it works. It does not mean that your spouse will want to do things the same way. Consider this: their family had their own manners and traditions, which to them are equally valid. So, you must learn to work together in harmony, showing respect, honor, understanding, and love toward each other. Now, that sounds like something very simple that you learned in kindergarten. I don't know if you remember, but about 20 years ago there was this book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten by Robert Fulham. One of the best books I've ever read, because it's so true. Well, play nice, treat other people with respect, and it sounds so simple, you know, that it's taught to kids in kindergarten. But I can tell you, as an adult, it's hard to do. It's easy to hear and hard to do. Marriage brings it right into your face. You have to get along. You have to learn how to get along. Of course, now we're talking about trying to have a happy marriage. I think that should be understood. A godly marriage is a happy marriage, I think. So it sounds very simple, yet this is a highly spiritual principle. If you think about it, this is, again, high-level spiritual instruction, getting along with people. Not meaning, of course, that you just let anything go, but that's another subject. And it's a principle that reflects the relationship between Christ and the church, if you think about it. All those important truths are also there in Christ's relationship with the church, your relationship with Christ. So number two, joined and united together. So the man leaves his father and mother, and he cleaves to his wife in the old King James. He is united to his wife, he is joined to his wife. Another way to say it might be that they bond, and it's more of a thing we say nowadays, yeah, we're bonding, you know? Yeah, you bond with your wife, you bond with your husband. Other than bonding with God, your father, and Jesus Christ, your elder brother, your spouse should be your highest commitment and priority. We build that bond through actions. We build that bond through actions. Kind of giving you some takeaways now. physical affection, hugs, kissing, affectionate and kind words, gifts, acts of service, spending time together, a willingness, why are you laughing at me? She's laughing at me. A willingness to listen, showing humility in working out your differences. Who's aware of the Love Languages book? Have you ever? Yeah, okay, it's pretty common. It's kind of part of culture now. If you're not familiar with it, you should read it. Because it kind of clues you in. Yeah, not everybody expresses love and affection. And everybody does has their own recipe, if you will. And it's good to know what other people, where they're coming from. It's good to know where your spouse is coming from. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that, you know, you don't want to fill in all the blanks. But some people are stronger in other areas. Some people receive love a certain way, give love a certain way. It's good to be in tune with that, but it's also good to kind of fill out the blanks. A common misconception is that love is an emotion. Something you feel. It just takes over your life, and I have no control. I've been captured by the love tractor beam, and there's no escape. Not so. Desire is an emotion, and it can be good, leads you to a good thing. Desire is an emotion, but the love that desire leads to is actions. The truth is that loving relationships have to be worked at, and that they require mental and physical effort. Not to go over all the same points, but love is care, consideration that is shown to or done towards the other person. Think of James when he talks about faith and works. And he says, well, you say you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith. I'll show you my faith through my works. And I'm paraphrasing him, of course. But what he's saying is, I show you my faith through what I do, how it plays out in my life. And that's how you have love in your marriage. That's how you build love in your marriage. It's by what you do. Sometimes people fall out of love. Oh, I stopped. I just don't feel the way about you that I used to. I've fallen out of love with you. Well, I'm not saying this is always the case, but very often it just means you stopped doing the things you needed to do to show love, or the other person stopped doing that. And I realize that people reach a point where there's just no return. But I also know that I know of a couple where they kind of got into that situation and someone pointed it out to them. Said, well, you're not doing the things you need to do. And they started doing them. I know this couple. And it really made a difference. Just saying, not a guarantee, no money back guarantee from me, but do the work and you'll reap the results. Number three, oneness, becoming one flesh. All right, now we're getting down to the good stuff, right? Okay, becoming one flesh. Turn with me to 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7. Interesting little verse, a little instruction. And Paul, this is part of a long section on marriage and sexuality and stuff like that, where he covers all kinds of good, bad, and ugly. And he says in chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, he says this to couples in his congregation. He said, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife. He's talking about sex. But I think, you know, he's probably also talking about affection. But he is, you know, he's talking about the basics here. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. And in the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Then he says to them, do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time. You have to have a sunset clause on any kind of agreement like that. and for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come back together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So he's saying to them, it's very important. And if you're going to kind of like put it on the shelf, you know, better, he's saying, well, you know, if you need more spiritual time. And I read an interesting article on the background here where a lot of these people were slaves and they didn't have a lot of spare time. So they needed to make time for spiritual things like prayer and so forth because they had to work a lot. And he's saying, I think, he could be saying, if you need extra time for prayer or something like that, you decide to kind of like take a little bit out of the sex column and put it into the prayer column, that's good. But don't do it too much and don't do it for an extended period of time and make sure that you come back because it's very important. It's a very important part of your relationship. I don't know if that's exactly what was happening at the time, but it seems to kind of make sense. And it's definitely what he's saying is don't make it a permanent thing. And it's very important, and it really is not to be put aside except for something very important, like your spiritual responsibilities and duties and desires. But even then, come back. I thought it's an interesting little scripture. The loving sexual relationship is central to marriage, a successful marriage. It's very important. Got another rhetorical question. Please don't answer this one. What is sex? What is sex? I mean, that's actually part of the whole thing with the Supreme Court. What is sex? Well, today people talk about human sexuality as nothing more than a necessary biological function. Animals breathe, so do people. Animals eat, so do humans. Animals have sex, so do humans. I want it, I need it, I'll get it where I can, when I can. Right? Simple. I'm thirsty, I drink. Right? That's kind of the approach that people have nowadays. Human sex is different. And I've already laid the groundwork of why it should be, and I think you're putting the puzzle pieces together. But why would I say that? Why would I say that human sex is different from polar bear sex or whatever? What makes sex more than a mere biological function when it's human men and women who are doing it? Well, one thing, and this is only a small point, but only humans appear to engage in sex for pleasure outside of reproduction. And in that way, it's one of the means by which a man and a woman unite and bond their lives together, as mentioned in the previous point, number two. Also, for human sex to be safe and secure for both parties, it needs to be performed, if you will, in an environment of faithfulness and loyalty, which only marriage can provide. Sex outside of marriage is a minefield of disease, contamination, and trouble, producing children outside of marriage is often dangerous and disastrous and destructive. It's just the way it is. It's meant to be part of the marriage relationship. As part of human reproduction, sex within marriage is also a very special act that we are to hold in high esteem. It's the act that, if you think about it from a full or fully informed perspective, it is an act that leads to the creation of a new being who also bears the image of God. And in this way, becoming one flesh, in this way, is part of it. We fulfill God's desire expressed earlier that we increase, that we produce. And what he's looking for is godly offspring. Turn to Malachi 2. Malachi 2. Verse 15, last book of the Old Testament, for anyone who wonders, that's how I always find it. And in chapter 2, verse 15, I'll just, because we're just kind of going to dive in here and look at a scripture, the context is people are wondering, well, why isn't God blessing us? Why does he seem to be angry or mad at us? And it's because they're willy-nilly divorcing their wives, they're not faithful, they're not loyal. God does not like that. And God says to them in reply to their question, why? Why is this happening to us? He says, has not the one God made you? And this perhaps is the voice of Malachi, but of the words of God. Has not the one God made you? You belong to him in body and spirit. And what does the one God seek? Godly offspring. And then he goes on saying, you know, so to be on your guard and do not be unfaithful to the wife of your youth. Talking there about adultery and divorce and so forth. But the concept that I want to draw out here is that God earnestly desires that we produce godly offspring. I have no doubt that God could make humans out of the dust of the ground if he wanted to, but he's given you a part in it. He's given you a part in his awesome plan to reproduce himself. You have a small part to play, but you do have a part to play. And it's something to think about when you think about human sexuality and when you think about marriage. Human sex is the act that initiates a new life. After the likeness of God. In the flesh, of course, but it also has the potential to become a spirit life in the family of God, of the God kind. Have you ever, if you have kids, and I know some of us are at various stages of child rearing, but have you ever looked at your kid, son, your daughter, and said, wow, that person has this, that's a person, first step. That person has the same potential to be a son of God as I do. Because they do. Now, caveat, it is not the sex act itself, but it's the product of sexual activity. The godly offspring that fulfills our physical part in God's plan to reproduce himself. Why do I make that caveat? Well, because if you look at history, confusion along these lines leads the infinitely creative human mind into some very weird and creepy places when they start thinking of the sex act as something religious or sacred or some sacramental thing. That's not what we're talking about here. I found myself almost saying that, and I thought, whoa, I need to pull back on that, because people go astray on that. And they want to bring the sex act into their worship. Well, your marriage is part of your worship, if you will, and what comes out of it and all the beauty that's there. But just be careful, just saying. Okay, moving on, turn to Hebrews 13, verse 4. I know that's not really a problem that we see in our day and age, but frankly, I think that's actually part of the whole marriage thing with the Supreme Court and all that. They want to bring spirituality into the whole thing. It doesn't belong there. Anyway, sorry. Okay, Hebrews 13, verse 4. Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure. And it goes on to say that, for God will judge the adulterer and the sexually immoral. Because of the role human sexuality has in God's design for the universe, it has to be, it should be, and we must insist upon it, treat it as something honorable, hold it on a high level in high esteem, and kept pure. Now, I think the element of purity introduced here is sort of a New Testament reference to the Old Testament teaching on clean and unclean. That's my opinion, my interpretation of it. Clean, unclean, holy, defiled, and so forth. But it could also just be a reference to purity in the sense of unmixed with foreign elements. You know, like pure gold. Right? We have a bit of a divide there because Hebrews is in the Greek language. You know, some of the references to purity and stuff like that in the Old Testament, they're different words, and it's hard to be certain. But I think the concept is not lost on you. Either way, it is a state or a status, if you will, that human sexuality can only achieve within the boundaries of marriage, according to God's purpose and design. Purity. Likewise, this parallel is important. Likewise, the relationship of Christ and the church is honorable, pure, faithful, loyal, safe, secure, all these things we've talked about in this point, for those who are part of the assembly of God. And his desire is that we be at one with him. And we see this as his picture and goal and design for what we should learn and experience. Because we don't just learn by reading words on a page. You learn by experiencing, by doing. Marriage is one of those ways you learn. You learn some very spiritual lessons from being in a marriage. His desire is that we be one with him. Now, another caveat. Sex outside of marriage also produces new life. And that life is in the image of God, in the likeness of God. And that new life is not to be looked down upon. That new life has the same potential for sonship in the family of God as anyone. But the sexual relationship or asexual relationship outside of marriage is not a good thing, and it does not picture the relationship of Christ in the church. It's something completely different. But that child is still important and made in the image of God and has the full potential that you do. I say that because I don't think people do it so much anymore, but there was a time when people would hold it against the child. That's not right. You know that. I know that. Scriptures say that. Okay, number four, not ashamed, or goodness, if you will. Genesis 2, verse 25. Oh yeah, we read this already. I'm just going to kind of refresh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. The man and the woman were not ashamed to be naked when they were together. And the main point here is that sexuality is not something that's dirty. Even though people call it the nasty, it's not nasty. It's good, as God said. It's not degrading or beneath you or gross. And the husband and wife should feel comfortable with each other's body and with their respective femininity and masculinity. So the first man and woman were alone. And there was really no potential for outsiders to kind of look at them and see what was going on. And it just, you know, wasn't a factor. It is a factor now, though, because there's other people on the planet. So their nakedness together, and the first man and the first woman, is not an argument for public nudity. Yes, believe it or not, people do that. It is not an argument for public nudity as some sort of more natural and more godly state. Uh-uh. Nor is it a rationalization for boldly revealing your body parts to other people. I'm not ashamed. I'm like the original person. No, that is not the case. Now, I don't have any regulations for you on hemlines or necklines or heel heights or tightness or sheerness. I want you to work that out for yourselves, okay? But I do have some spiritual principles that I want you to consider when you are working out your wardrobe. The first, enticement and temptation. Overly revealing clothing on both men and women is sort of like an invitation to outsiders and strangers into that physical intimacy that should only be experienced and known in marriage. I realize it's, you know, there's a lot of connections that have to be made, but it's like the first opening round, if you will. Now, I understand also that this is conditioned by the setting, you know, what is considered overly revealing here at Sabbath services or walking around in the mall is different from what is considered excessively revealing at a beach, a public beach or a swimming pool or something like that. Use wisdom. Use the wisdom that God has given you through the presence of the Holy Spirit in your mind, and be willing to take counsel from the older generation in this regard. That's all I have to say on that one. Second point is pride and vanity. Now, I've heard this statement, and I probably won't hear it anymore because people think, oh, he's a pastor, I can't say anything to him anymore. But I've heard in the past a couple of things. One is, well, my husband likes it when I dress like this. He wants me to look sexy. I've heard that a couple of times in different sources. Another one I hear a lot is, well, I want to look attractive and modern. Okay. I'm not going to offer you a psychoanalysis on what's driving ideas like this. All I ask is that you think about the motive and intent behind ideas like this. And look honestly at your own intent. Like I said, I don't have any rules for you. My goal is to just get you to think about it, make your own mind up. Partly because you're going to do it anyway. First Peter 3, verse 1 through 7. And I think that's something, you know, more by way of reminder, if you will. But it comes up from time to time. And, you know, I mean, I have my own standards about what I think is overly sexy, and you might think, well, you're weird. But, and we all do. I understand that. And it's hard to nail it all down. That's why I'm not going to give you any rules or anything like that. Let's read 1 Peter 3, verse 1 through 7 together, if you would. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the sexiness and hotness of your outfit. That's not what it says. So that they will be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord and Master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, I'm going to go on and read this because I'll refer to it later. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as how you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So modesty in how we reveal ourselves, and even married couples need to think about this. I think especially married couples, frankly, but everyone does. Modesty in how we reveal our bodies says a lot about us as a person. What is your level of respect for your own sexuality and its high-level purpose in God's plan? What is your level of respect for others in not leading them into lust or envy, if you will? What is your level of respect for God and His desire that sexuality be contained within a marriage relationship that is pure and set apart. So just think about those things. And it might seem like a bit of a tangent, but when we're talking about human sexuality, it's something that comes into play. It just is. And I think we're just going to have to keep working at it as time rolls on. You know, Laura and I have had kids, and they want to do stuff, and we just had one recently where one of our kids came home with something, and I said, no way. That is too sexy. I mean, you look really hot. You are not buying that. It's not happening. it just, you know, it's part of life. And it's one of those things you learn as you go, and we make mistakes. I get it. Okay. Number five, God-ordained authority. And this one is not from Genesis, but it's important when we're talking about marriage. As we've mentioned, the marriage relationship teaches us about the relationship of Christ and the church, right? And the relationship of Christ and the church teaches us about marriage. It goes both ways. Christ's relationship to the church is a model of loving leadership and appropriate respect for the leader's authority. Ephesians 5. Well, you knew we'd end up there eventually, right? Ephesians 5. And let's just read the whole section here, verses 22 through 33. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husband as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body. But they feed and care for their body just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. And for this reason, a man, and he quotes here the verse that we started off with, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. I did a word thing on this. I have a program where I just wave my little cursor over the words, and it pops up with the Greek word and the definition and all that. And all these places where it says love, husbands, you should love your wife. The word there is agape. And we talk about this as a church now and then. Agape. It's a godly love. Godly love, with all that that implies and means. It's not, you know, the brotherly love. It's not the eros, the erotic love. It's godly love. It's that agape love. I think you should have the other two kinds of love in there, too. It'd be good. But what we're talking about here is agape. I just thought that was interesting. Now, another interesting one, you might not like this as much, there at the end where it says, and the wife must respect her husband. That word there is phobia, phobio, which means fear. Same word you would use in a phrase like, fear the Lord. Doesn't mean that you, yeah, but it means that you respect and have reverence. If you're reading the old King James, it uses the word reverence. And it's something that God asks you to do. The way Jesus leads the church is the way husbands should lead their wives and their families. And Jesus Christ is indeed the model of selfless love, that agape love, toward you. He's committed to you. He attends to your needs. He hears you when you need to talk. And he always has your best interests at heart. A human leader like that, if there was such a thing, a human leader like that would be easy to follow, wouldn't they? Say, yeah, I can follow someone like that. Right, yeah. Well, let's just take a look at the response to loving leadership. Loving leadership does not guarantee a positive response. Would you treat a loving leader as a pushover? Because there's no patience. They don't come down on you right away. Christ is very patient with me, with you. How do you respond to loving leadership? Would you, you know, think of it as an opportunity to get your way? Or would you respond with respect? I think a lot of people go, and I'm not talking about the church here now, I have to just tell you, I'm kind of thinking about the world at large. Many people seem to take Christ's love for granted, and they don't respond with respect for his commands. And you know, we see that in marriage. Someone might say, yeah, but my husband isn't like that. I'd start respecting him if he'd just shape up. Well, women, you cannot withhold respect until he begins to act the way you behave. Sorry, I said that wrong. You cannot withhold respect until he begins to act the way you want. Sorry. It's like saying, well, I'll agree with you when you say something that makes sense. Or I'll agree with you when you say something that I agree with. And men, you cannot command that she submit while acting in a manner that is unloving. It just doesn't make sense. Is that how Christ deals with the church? Is that how he deals with you as an individual? No, it isn't. Now, the scriptures clearly teach that both in marriage and in life, each of us should do our part, even if the other person does not. Easy to say, hard to do. Individuals acting alone, and we have scriptures we can turn to. We read one of them in 1 Peter 3. Individuals acting alone can positively influence their marriage partner. It's not guaranteed, but it's definitely the biblical model. Do your part. Do your part. And this is, you know, something it's an admonition for both men and women. Do your part first. Don't wait for the other person to do their part and then I'll do my part. You do your part first and then I'll do mine. Does that ever work in life? Does it ever work in life? Never. And so in marriage, you do your part. You do it first. You take the first step. Why are men in charge? Why are men in charge? Are women inferior? Well, I think we talked about that from the very beginning. No. Is marriage a sexist or a demeaning relationship for women? Well, I have a reciprocal question. If women were in charge, wouldn't we be asking, why are women in charge? Wouldn't we? Really? We'd be asking that same question. So consider this. As I said, it's not a matter of like designed inferiority. It's a status thing, though. It is a status thing, and it's something that has been ordained, status. Somebody has to be in charge. Somebody has to be in charge. Why are Levites Levites? Well, somebody has to be the priest and Levite. If they weren't, then what would we do? We'd have to have a different system, right? If men weren't in charge, we'd have to have a different system in marriage, wouldn't we? What would that system be? It'd be competition, wouldn't it? If authority in the family were merit-based, then marriage would be, by definition, a contest to see who's on top. Now, I'm not kidding myself that that's not part of marriages and it doesn't happen all the time, but that's not the plan. That's not the design. The idea is, you know, we set that aside. That's settled. Marriage is not to be a constant struggle for dominance and control. I mean, if it wasn't defined, and this is for people who have the Holy Spirit, who understand God's teaching on marriage, we'd be so obsessed about who's in charge that we wouldn't have any time to really spare thinking about or doing all that other good stuff that we just talked about. Love, harmony, oneness, loyalty, affection, and all that other stuff, which is very similar, if you think about it, to putting on the mind of Christ. And, you know, They are very similar. So when Christ returns, he will have all authority. There will be no contest. to see who's the best or the most fit to lead. Let me see that concept now in marriage. I'm not saying that the best person is always in charge, but it's settled. I want you to focus on these other things. Think about how much time, when Christ returns, there's not going to be a contest about who's the best person, who's most fit to lead. No politics or war. And those are two things that how people thrash it all out. Think about how much time and energy and pain goes into determining who's in charge in human society. It's also something in your marriage. It's not something that you need to spend a lot of time on. You need to focus on the other stuff. When Christ is in charge, we won't be worried about that. We'll have time to focus on the actions that express love and harmony and respect and oneness and unity and so much more. All those things that we've talked about as being part of a marriage, it's going to be over the earth, like this, you know, like the waters of the sea, you know, right up to your nose with unity and love. Because certain things just won't be on the table for discussion. Think about how much time, and energy, and money, how many bullets we spend figuring out who's going to be in charge. And when it's off the table, we'll have time to focus on some other things. Likewise, in marriage. Your marriage, if you determine in your heart and in your mind to follow God's instructions for it, gives you the opportunity to start putting all those good things, like the unity and the oneness and the love, the mind of Christ, it's the perfect opportunity for you to start putting those things into practice in your life today.